Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Slacker Podcast with myself, Phil Taggart. Thank you for joining us on this season. What season are we on now? Season 5. We are an old podcast now. We're getting our pension. We're getting on the bus. We've done loads. There must be 60 or 70 episodes of podcasts with loads of different artists for you to enjoy. Wherever it is you get your podcast, whether it's Apple or Spotify or Deezer or Castbox or Google or wherever. And I'm scrolling through them right now. I mean, there's episodes there that you mightn't have listened to, from Matt Berninger from The National, Action Bronson, Curtin Vile, Daniel Avery, Jarvis Cocker, Jaden Smith, Bob Geldof, Sleaford Mods, KSI Phineas, Johnny Burrell, Phoebe Bridgers, Run the Jewels, James Vincent McMorrow, James Blunt, that was a fun one, Jimmy World, LaRue, there's loads. I mean, they're just, you can scroll as you're looking at this right now. And yeah, we're well and truly established as one of the biggest and most important music podcasts, interview-wise anyway, in the UK. The podcast is all about kind of like almost like a chronological look at their career that fizzes off and goes in various different directions. And this week is no different. Before I get to this week's podcast and who is on it and who joins us, I want to talk about my brand new show, which is on Spotify. It's called Chill the Beats, C-H-I-L-L-D-A-B-E-A-T-S. It is all one word, and it is the chillest show on Spotify, which means it's the chillest show in all of audio land. It's just me picking the best records and playing them for you, releasing it every single Sunday. You can listen to it whenever you want. A lot of people listen to it when they feel a little bit stressed, when they feel a little bit moody, when they need to take some time to themselves. Like, as the weather is getting better, a lot of the people who listen to the show are going out and going on long walks and going to the beach if they can, to go and sort of just soak in the 2 or 2.5 hours of music that I picked. That's both new and old in places. Some tracks you'll haven't heard in ages, and some tracks you'll have never heard before. And it is just pure and utter unadulterated mellow sounds. And you know, the music's pretty good to boot. So if you're listening to this, you're a music fan. If you're a music fan, I think you'll like the Chill the Beats show. You can also join the community. We've got this community on Discord. If you're fresh to Discord and you don't know what it is like a massive chat room that has loads of different little bits that you can talk about. We have the main chat, we have the music chat, we have the support club for people who need a little bit of just support in their life. We have the sports, we have all sorts of different fun bits and pieces, which I will link to below. And you can join Chill the Beats on Patreon, which is patreon.com/chilledabeats. And it's updated much more regularly than the Slacker Patreon, if anybody wants to sort of move over from the Slacker Podcast Patreon to the Chill Debates one. I'm putting loads of bonus episodes up there at the moment. I've just started a new series called The Masters, and that is only for people who subscribe to the Patreon. And this week it is all about Nina Simone, and I play music that influenced her coming up. I play some of the deep tracks from her albums. I play artists that have been indelibly influenced by her, like Brittany Howard. I play covers of her music from Jeff Buckley. And we sort of wind in and around about an hour and a half through her career. And it's one of the best things I've made, and it's only on Patreon. So you can go to patreon.com/chilledabeats, or you can sign up at patreon.com/slackerpodcast. It is completely and utterly up to you. I thank you very much for any support that you guys give. When you make independent content and you're not like assigned to like a massive corporation, you rely on it, like you definitely do. Our podcast guests this week is a duo from Worthing / Brighton. I was one of the first, if not the first, to play them on the radio back in like 2012. God, I feel so old. That will be 10 years. Oh my God. Don't have an esoteric crisis. Don't have an existential crisis on the microphone right now. But I've known them since the very, very beginning. I tried to sign them to my label. I'm a big, big fan of Mike and Ben from Royal Blood. They are our Slacker Podcast guests. You're going to really enjoy the demo that we have as well. And here it is, Slacker Podcast with Royal Blood in 3, 2. Guys, thank you for joining me on the Slacker Podcast. Let's kick in like we normally do with a demo. This is a demo of I Only Lie. Timestamp is for me. Like, when was this from?
It's all a bit of a blur, to be honest with you. I'm pretty sure this was from when we went to a studio in, well, just outside Bath. And it was the first time we had really got together and almost like retreated to go and write for the second record. Mm-hmm. And we'd just introduced ourselves to the idea of recording ourselves, which was very fun. We probably spent like too much time working out how to open a new track, how to like get it to be on.
Yeah.
But it did. It was an important process for us because it was the first time we began thinking about, I guess, how we wanted our music to come across. And yeah, we got more into, the recording side of it as well as the writing. So, pretty sure this was in Bath. It was a pretty mental period of time as well. I remember Ben once, we went out on a night out in Bath and Ben actually ran home. And in order to run from Bath city centre to the studio, you basically have to go on a motorway.
it was like 6 a.m. running down a motorway.
You're lucky you didn't get like picked up by the cops.
Yeah, it's too early for them. Or late.
Perfect time for crime, if anyone's interested.
I'm pretty sure that like Alan Partridge once walked down a motorway.
Yeah.
Was that the inspiration behind that?
Basically, my phone ran out of battery and I had to get home. I had to get back. And that's the only way I knew.
Well, listen, I'll like let that image like conjure in people's heads as they listen to this demo. Here it is, Royal Blood, I Only Lie. that was a demo of Royal Blood. I Only Lie on the Slacker podcast. Guys are joining me right now. You say that this is like sort of like when you started recording yourselves like in earnest before, but like, I mean, what state did you have demos and things like that before the first record, or did everything come sort of fully ready?
We didn't demo anything on our first album. Every song was really born out of a rehearsal space. I think, demoing is a new thing for us on the second record. But one thing that became a theme as well is like multiple demos, which can be a bad thing, but for us at the time, that was quite a good thing because we would, every time we went back to demo, we would kind of work on the song more and more. And although that's a demo of I Only Lie and I Love You, it's probably like one of five. And they kind of just progress because I think we were getting to the point where, by the time we actually went into the studio to do it for real, we wanted to know that we'd explored every avenue and we knew how we wanted to do it, you know, so we could focus on the performance.
You can get really lost in like demo-itis, like on stuff like that too. And really the only thing that massively changes in any of the artists that I've ever worked with on my label is it's the beat, Ben, isn't it? Like, I mean, like you're going, all right, this is a straight up rock track. Let's try it with a disco beat. Let's try it with a halftime. Let's try it with a, like the demos, like bit is really more to do with the drummer and the rhythm really, isn't it? More than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a part of it. I think for us, the demoing thing becomes a puzzle piece, and it's sections that Mike and I write together. And it's where they should go in the song and where they fit in with other things that we've written. Mm-hmm. So the demoing thing is kind of seeing if this section should come after this section almost, and if it even works together. You know, there's things that we've gone in and just completely taken out of things because they're not needed. And yeah, but there's definitely a feel element to it, of course.
Is there like a, because there's so many riffs in your tracks and it's so riff heavy. Well, it had, like, you know, has been for a long time. Like, is there an element of going, I've got a shit ton of riffs, like I have a fucking library of them and I can just go and grab off the top shelf that one and let's see if it works with this one and just try and shit out like that?
Totally, yeah. There's a kind of arsenal of them and it's about finding a good enough home for them. So there's riffs from the first album that I've still got in my back pocket, which I know are great, but I want them to be presented in the best example possible.
Yeah. But
like stuff, tunes from the new record, like a popular writing tactic of mine was like, I'll write 20 riffs all for the same song. Just like one after, as soon as I had one, I'd like get it down and then I'd move on and do another one. And I'd spend and try and literally do that in like an hour and then like leave, come back, listen to them, and it's like gambling. The more you roll the dice, the more likely you are to win, you know. There's no money involved. So I'd come back and be like, okay, most of them are shit, but that's fucking great. That's really cool. That's great. And then, yeah, you kind of collect riffs that feel like they're friends and go in and out of each other very easily. And then it becomes, then we can kind of write the song a lot smoother, you know, because I think just having loads of riffs and hoping they go together it's like trying to force puzzle pieces together, you know? It doesn't always work.
It sounds like Tinder, but for riffs. You're just coming back and you're just like left, 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 right, right, left.
A swipe system into the studio.
Who are your sort of like drum heroes and riff heroes? Like, I'll give you both an answer. Like, I mean, who are the ones that you sort of look up to? Because like, I know from speaking to, like, I deal with young people quite a lot in music, and, you know, you would be theirs in terms of like who their rock icons would be. Like, who would your drum icon be, Ben?
It's an interesting question, because I would probably say Ringo. I think the way he plays drums and he comes up with hooks is something that I've kind of latched onto. You know, he's not such a flamboyant drummer, but he, you know, if you listen to Come Together, you know exactly what that song is. Yeah. But I think like that mixed in like probably Dave Grohl and things that he did with Nirvana, like in Bloom and stuff like that, is such an iconic song to me. So I'll go with probably Dave Grohl.
Yeah, I see Ringo, because Ringo has that style because he's a jazz drummer and he uses the toms as like melodious instruments more so than just something to make it sound heavy as fuck. Whereas like Dave Grohl kind of almost goes the other way where he uses toms to make it sound heavy as fuck. I mean, like my favorite drum record of all time is Songs for the Deaf. I don't think there's a better album for drumming than that the whole way through.
Absolutely. I think for me growing up, it was Blood Sugar Sex Magik, because it was just so, it brought the funk rock element to it. It was really groovy, and definitely Delouse in the Crematorium by the Mars Volta with John Theodore playing drums. That absolutely blew my mind when I heard that drumming on that.
What about when it comes to riffs for you, Mike? Like obviously, like somebody who's a massive fan of yours, you've presented them with awards, they presented you with awards. Like, it's hard to look around Jimmy Page, like when it comes to riffs, right? But like, who would your hero be?
Yes, so there's so many, and none of them are bass players. They're all guitarists. I think Tom Morello is definitely on the mantelpiece for his simplicity and his ability to pick two or three notes, and they become so powerful and iconic. And I always enjoyed his philosophy on riff writing, where he would write them on this beat up Spanish acoustic. And if they sounded big, if they sounded kind of heavy, whatever that means, on the acoustic, then they made it to the rig, you know, to the big ad guitar amps up. And I just like the idea of that riffs are heavy. It's the content of the riff. It's the composition of the riff that makes it heavy. It's not distortion or how many amps you have.
Yeah.
So I really believed in that. And I guess you can hear that on like Out of the Black and stuff, where it's like so inspired by things like Bulls on Parade, you know, it's like an octave.
It's funny because like with Tom Morello, a lot of it's not to do with like, you know, your typical guitar patterns are these like pentatonics, like which everybody sort of runs around the scale on. It's about like, it's very hard for me as like a non sort of musician. I mean, I play a bit of bass, but I'm shy. Like, but it's like the really harder notes that are right beside each other. Like, you know, your Master of Puppets and your bomb track and Killing in the Name Of. That's what makes it heavy. It's the fact that it's kind of a little bit not the note that you're expecting it to be.
Yeah, there's always a little like head turner for sure. I think Jimmy Page is probably the biggest influence on me. Again, it's so the actual, obviously the solos are unbelievable and I could never play like that, but the riff writing and it's where he kind of sits on the drums as well. It's like he's always on the other side. I don't know. I'm not very theory nerdy or anything like that.
Yeah, no, like, I know what you mean. Like songs like Kashmir and stuff, he feels like he's chasing it.
Yeah, and yeah, again, like the biggest riffs are the simplest ones. I'm trying to think who else really.
Even like the song like Black Dog kind of reminds me of you guys a little bit, like because it's a heavy riff, but the drum pattern is almost at, like, is at odds with it, but which makes it an incredible rock track. Do you know what I mean? Like when you get Black Dog, people play it on the guitar and stuff, but if you set a drummer down to play it, they're like, shit, this is really hard.
Yeah, it's so chilled out. It's so like laid back, the drums on that. This is just lazy, isn't it? He was lazy.
Yeah, John Bonham. Yeah. What were like the sort of formative acts that you guys bonded over when you were kids? Like, because I mean, we're all roughly about the same age, and for me, it was like the Kerrang loop, where Kerrang would loop every 2 hours or 3 hours, and you would know when Puddle of Mud was coming on. You would know when POD Alive was coming on. You would know when Papa Roach was coming on. You know, like you almost like could flip and time it because you just sat in front of it, like drinking it in as a kid. Like what, like did you have a similar experience or was it different?
I think we were both so just had such a like anything goes attitude to music when we were younger. So we kind of bonded over the ability to kind of be in a band and have one song that sounds like a funk song and then another song that sounds like Coldplay and then another song that sounds like it's from At the Drive-In. And I think we loved exploring all types of music in our when we were kind of 15, you know. But I think as we got older and it became really serious, it was really the heaviness that all the heavy bands that kind of kept our interest. Like, yeah, Songs for the Deaf was such a staple record for me because I didn't think I could be a singer of a rock band because I can't scream and I don't have the like
you don't have the guttural,
I don't have the Chris Cornell thing
or the rasp. Yeah,
I was like, oh, I can't, it's in my head. And then when I heard Queens of the Stone Age, I was like, oh, I can sing in the band because in a rock band because Josh has a soft voice and it's gentle, and I was like, my voice is quite feminine and I love T-Rex and things like that. So yeah, suddenly it was like, hang on a minute. So bands like Songs for the Deaf were like, Queens of the Stone Age became really a center point, and Nirvana. And we loved the craziness about the drive-in and like the idea of, in our early bands, we would like love the idea that you show up and you're like the band that just fucking climbs on everything and wrecks everything.
Yeah.
It was very like performance led, I think. I don't think we sat down and wrote a list of our influences. It was more that we loved being in front of people and like causing a bit of trouble.
Well, like, and you do, like, I've never seen a band that feeds off energy more. Like you love a drum, like, you know, a good big drum riser posture, Ben. Like, you know, it's almost like your yoga pose with your sticks, sort of.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, being two people in the band, there's a lot more I can do, and you know, being right at the front with Mike, where drummers are not meant to be, you know, already we're breaking the rules there, really. And so, you know, if you're going to be at the front, you gotta go big.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
That's it. I mean, look at Slipknot. Like one of the first gigs I ever went to was Slipknot in the Odyssey in Belfast. And I think I might've been 14 and was dragged along with my friend because his mom wanted him to be there with somebody else. Like a 14-year-old me was a good chaperone for another 14-year-old. But I remember seeing Joey Jordison's drum kit, like doing not a 360, but almost like a 270. And that being a massive like changing moment in my life, going, holy shit. People can actually do that. You can wear a mask, go 270 in a drum kit and live a life as a millionaire. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
What can you remember the first time you ever actually played together? Like, what was that moment like? Was it in a different band, or like, were you just jamming in a room? How did that go?
Yeah, it was in the band called Flavor Country that we were in when we were about 14 or 15. And
that's a Simpsons reference, isn't it? Flavor Country.
So yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were a three piece, and Ben was drumming in lots of different bands, but he loved the band that I was in. I was playing guitar. And I kind of was like, yeah, I did backup vocals in guitar. And Ben was like a big fan of the band and just was basically on MSN, just like, I reckon I've got some like great parts for these songs. Ben was like, I could make this even better. So I just turned up to band practice one day and was like, Ben's coming down. They were like, me, and they're like, what's he gonna do? And I was like, guitar. And they were like, okay. And then as soon as he joined the band, it all just made sense.
Yeah.
And it was great because it was ridiculous, you know. Everyone was on the wrong instrument, and it was just very funny. Again, that's kind of, we would show up to places which we either like weren't invited to or had like lied tremendously about what it was we were offering.
Yeah. You're like, we could sell 500 tickets. We're like really popular. We're like the big cheese down the Cracker Factory in Worthing.
We played at Sixth Form College in Worthing once, and we just threw a PA in the back and showed up and just played at lunchtime. Everyone was trying to have lunch. We were jumping on tables. Ben actually jumped on a table and just kicked someone's lunch over. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Can you remember that person's face when you did it?
I remember standing on his crisp packet.
Kicked the fire exit door open as well.
Yeah, I fell out of it.
What are your chops like as a guitar player then, Ben?
Rhythmically was quite good. I've got quite small, stumpy hands, so a bit like Elton John.
I've always said.
I just really enjoyed it. And I think at that age, I had a lot of energy and just loved writing music. And I'd been a drummer, you know, my whole life until that point, where it was nice just to do something new.
Does that give you a bigger place in the writing of the music? Like obviously being a drummer and being able to play guitar, you understand it probably a lot better that way.
Definitely. I think I never really listened to just the drums. I'm listening to, yeah, the guitars. And I think that definitely helps with our writing and how we work together.
Does it make it difficult for you pairing back a little bit on the new stuff? Because like, you know, you're so used to like, I don't know, just like being a big, massive rock drummer and almost play, some of the stuff that you're doing now, you're playing more simplistic beats because it goes better with the new sound. Like, do you have to, like, obviously you haven't probably toured this yet, I'd imagine, unless you've been out in the UAE playing gigs on a rooftop somewhere. But do you have to have a bit more discipline with the new stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, it's not so much discipline. It's more, because this one's more groove based. It's more, there's a lot more going on musically. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just Mike riffing out and me accompanying, you know, those kind of things. It's more listening to what's going on and giving those things space. But also I'm doing a lot of those bits on the drums. So when you hear Troubles coming, you know, all those string parts I'm playing on the drums. So it actually is a lot more complicated for me.
Yeah.
I saw somebody reference Troubles coming as, what did it say? I think it was NME. Their Daft Punk take on rock music. How did you feel about that?
Yeah, why not?
Well, I mean, there's not really much you can do or say about what people write about you.
I'll take it all.
Yeah, why not? I didn't know that Royal Blood were obviously, like, I've been a fan of yours for a long, like, since day dot, or what I thought day what dot was. And I remember having a conversation with one of you in the early days, or somebody telling me, going, he'd come back off a plane from Australia. He got picked up by his friend. And then they started Royal Blood to take over the fucking world, man. I didn't know Royal Blood was a band in Australia beforehand and that there was somebody else in it.
Yeah, I actually lived in Australia. Well, for about 8 months, I was in Australia. I know. And I think Royal Blood's like my kind of bass sound, the very like embryo of it was being in a three-piece band. And anyone that's in a three-piece knows that when the guitar solo comes, it usually sounds lame because there's this huge gap. So that's when I began adding amps to my sound. Mm-hmm. So I had an early band that kind of did that, really. Then bringing that sound and mixing it with Ben on the drums instead of these other guys that I was playing with, suddenly it was like a third sound was born out of the two of us playing together. But I think being in Australia as well, I was doing the kind of I'm gonna leave for a year, and I didn't really know that many people, so it allowed me to go to, I used to play a lot of open mic nights because it was somewhere I could sing in front of people and build confidence. And in Australia, they fucking love an open mic night. Everyone's got a fucking cajon. And
he had a cajon. He had a cajon. Worst instrument ever invented.
And then, but we, I remember just playing a lot of open mic nights. And there's something like being in another country where no one knows who you are. You know, I felt like I could essentially like cut some teeth and fuck up a bit. And when I came home, I was like, I wasn't afraid about singing on stage anymore. So it was a real like learning curve for me.
The way the story is presented, the narrative makes it sound like something like Step Brothers, where you're picked up from the airport and you kind of like have this like idea and you kind of turn to each other and you're like, did we just become best friends?
Yes. Yeah, the movie version of this would be so dramatic, whereas the reality of it was like very nonchalant, you know. It was more like, so I was thinking we should play the Tangerine next week, you up for it? Yeah, cool.
did you guys continue to do those open mic nights back here?
Yeah, that's the only way we could really get a gig.
How does a Royal Blood open mic night work? Because it obviously blows my, I can't think of it, I can't hear it.
I remember it was like desperately trying to get a gig. It was impossible. I went to all the venues in Brighton. I was like, I've just come from Australia. I've got this great band. We're really good. And it was just like, you've got to bring 30 friends. And if you don't, then you owe us money. And it was just ridiculous. It was like so difficult. So we were just like, fuck this. There's loads of open mic nights in Brighton. All we need to bring really is the drums and like a couple of amps, which some people do anyway. So we would just play in Brighton, and that's how we got in front of people. And I think very quickly we got attention from record labels and managers, and everyone was like, stop, go and hide.
So, yeah, I remember like that all that shit really happened very fast. For you guys,
but stop playing it over my nuts.
It's not like a sexy narrative, isn't it? Like, but I mean, like, how we discovered, like, how does that happen? Like, I remember a friend of mine sent me a link to come on over on SoundCloud, and it had a couple hundred plays, maybe.
Discovered on SoundCloud, we recorded four or five songs, and I think one of them was Figure It Out, and we put that up. And I remember, like, after a week, I didn't look at how many plays it had. I was like, I'm gonna wait a week, and I went. I was like, because I was like, this is the fucking best thing ever. And yes. I was like,
go.
And it was like, here we go. And it was like 204 or something. And I was like, fuck.
I think one of those might have been me, because like I remember being feeling really proud in years to come that I was like the first one to play Royal Blood on the radio. But I wasn't. Somebody in Triple J had played at Royal Blood like way before. So I was like, fuck that. So I just started a label at that time, and me and my friend Johnny were like, we're going to sign this band called Royal Blood. And we didn't even have a name for the label or anything. And I think Johnny may have reached out to you at the start of a week. And over the weekend that came, you had just installed your management as wildlife management to obviously look after Arctic Monkeys and many more. And out of courtesy, a guy called Joe Etchells from there had a meeting with us. and we were like, shit, we need to like look like we're professional. So we booked like a members club in Soho. And we took him there and he heard us out. I mean, he was like, God bless Joe, lovely man. He was just letting us put our pitch in. And then at the end of it, he was like, so what's the label called? And I was like, we don't have a name yet.
And just made one up on the spot.
It's like,
was there a look around the room?
Yeah, Royal Blood Label.
King.
But I it was exciting. It was very, very exciting when your music started, like, you know, when people started to hear it, because it connected with people instantaneously. And as you know from being in bands and groups and stuff beforehand, that doesn't happen. That's lightning in a bottle, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think it was very, very quick. And I think we're very, looking back, like, very grateful we've found the right manager very quickly, because suddenly our little Hotmail account was blowing up and I didn't know how to respond to emails anymore. And it was like coming after our blood, you know? So once those open mic nights kind of ended, it was a case of, writing more songs. And to be honest with you, I think we had five and we probably wrote six more. And then we put our first album out. It was like,
What sort of stuff were people promising you at that time? Because obviously there was like a big, sort of scuffle in the music industry of like, whoa, who's this new rock band? What were the conversations that were happening with like labels and people of that ilk? And they were like, we can make you the next fucking Good Charlotte, or we can like, we'll give you this Fabergé egg.
I think there was something more real about it because we weren't getting that. And we were seeing very select people.
Okay.
And it was the people we're meeting had a look in their eye like they had a winning lottery ticket and we could just smell it. So I think something more assuring than someone being like, I'm going to make you famous. It was almost like they had this like nervous energy of like them trying to impress us. And we were like, whoa, these people are like fucking scared.
I think that's like, basic like laws of attraction, isn't it? If you go out on a date with somebody, right, and you really, really, really fancy them, and you come in fucking shaking and sweaty, and you're like trying to, you know, you put on all of the cologne that you could.
Yeah, exactly.
You're never gonna get off of that person ever. Like,
for once, we felt like the hot girl.
we were really lucky, I think, to have our management, and we were also very lucky. We got a publishing deal before anything, and the guy that signed us with that is his name is Phil Christie, and he's now at Warner Records as the head there. And we've had people from the start, him and Wildlife, who have totally handled our situation really well for us and have guided us in a really healthy path to where we are today.
And like that I think a lot of like musicians do listen to this, and like it is like the golden ticket of getting your team right at the very beginning, because it's fair, like, you, I'm sure you know, like you hang about with like lots of other bands and stuff, and you see it all the time of people changing managers and PR and A&R and this, that, and the other. Having a locked team is so important.
Yeah, I think only when I started talking to other bands, I realized that our situation is quite unique. Because I meet other bands and they're like, oh, we don't even talk to our A&R guy. I was like, really? It's like,
the guy's an asshole.
It was that whole like us and them thing. And I'm like, I speak to like my A&R guy like every day. Like, we have like such a good and close relationship.
Yeah, that's great. And he's like, you're like, I farted and cupped it into my hands, it sounds great. He's like, okay, we'll put it out. Let's do it.
I, is not that. So which is why I respect him, you know, because the ability to have an honest opinion from someone who isn't in the band, you know.
That's it. Like, I mean, sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees and you just need somebody to sort of like help you out on that side of things.
We made it easy for him. We did make it easy for him given how good we were, you know, and and we'll continue to be, but you know.
Yeah, it's not polishing the turd, but it's just like putting a hat in it.
A&R this, it's finished. No.
Just like wrapping the CD in vinyl covers, that's all it goes to.
We are happy to have a good relationship and creative freedom as well. I think from the outside, like, people think when you get signed, you're sort of under this like controlled force. Mm-hmm. You know, like, people ask us like, so can you just like do what you want? Like, do you get to say, but people ask me like, do you get to say like what goes on the album? I'm like, yes, like it's our band. Like, so can you just put any song on? Can you just write what you want? And I'm like, oh my God.
But surely there has to be some sort of discussion in there. I'm sure that they're not like trying to pair you up with other famous celebrities or models or influencers for clout, but like there's bound to be a trade-off in there where they're like, oh, and this should be the single, and you're like, no, I think this should be the single. Like, it must be a give and take game, right?
Of course there is, but I guess what I'm getting at is there is, we have complete creative freedom, you know.
And like, I mean, having that freedom, like, it's quite clear like that you guys do, because like anytime I've talked to you about music or interviewed you, like over the years since like 2012 onwards, you've got this like kind of dichotomy where it's like half really serious and then half an ultimate piss take.
Well, they're always one click away, aren't they? You know, you go so serious that it's suddenly ridiculous again.
What's
dance between the two? I think it's important.
What's the most ridiculous thing that you've put in a song that even to this day you like, maybe an Easter egg or something like that, and you've just like, you just can't believe that that's a part of your music?
Oh, I know. In I Only Lie When I Love You, Ben is slapping his forehead in the choruses.
Oh yeah.
And is it audible?
Not like, oh yeah, it's well loud, and not just like hit it once and we'll like fly it around the track. It's like one take wonder.
Yeah, we were in the studio and I was in the booth and they could not see me, and that I was doing these claps, like, and they were like, and I was like trying just different things like this, and I was like, no, and I just went like and they were like that one. Yeah, they were like, and I was like, oh, that one.
Just following our ears, we were like, that's the best one. And then we looked in the booth and he's just hitting himself on the forehead.
Definitely puts a whole new meaning to the word slaphead. It really, doesn't it? I mean, it could be worse. Like, you could have to do it every single night of tour. The Pogues had somebody in their early iteration of the group that their only job was to play a beer tray on their head. So they would use the beer tray as, you know, as a percussive instrument, and would sit four of the five tracks. I think, I'm not sure if it was Spider Murphy, Spider Stacy. Oh, fuck, who knows? But he would play the tin whistle on a couple of tracks and then smack a beer head, a beer thing on his head the rest of the time. Imagine doing a world tour with that being your only thing. I know, but like, listen, there's so much that like we've got to talk about, and one of the things that like when it comes to like your bass sound, it's something that you've been asked a million billion 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 times, and I kind of want to come at it from a different angle. When you're in the studio and when you're putting together that bass sound, like how technical is it, and like, have you ever told anybody who it is apart from the sound engineer that you have?
It's something that's just developed over time. It started off as something incredibly simple that when we came out and like presented ourselves, I remember people kind of scratching their heads over it and having these very overcomplicated answers. The first one was that people thought we were playing on track, which was funny. I was like, brilliant. And then I realized that the joy in keeping things a secret, you know, it's more intriguing, you know. And then, yeah, it's just, I think every guitarist or bass player, as the albums progress, the setup becomes more complicated, because if you add four new pedals or new sounds to your record after like three or four albums, suddenly that's just accumulating. So now it's like a very technical setup. It's funny, like, I know people say, like, with a plethora of pedals, he's able to get guitar sound. And it's like, you should look at how many pedals everyone else has. I don't have that many pedals. If you look at AC/DC's setup, it's fucking insane. It's all Marshalls, but they're like hand selected. They have voltage. They change the voltage on them, so they match. It's like, it can go crazy. So, in considering on our third album, and we can sell out a venue or two, it's still pretty humble. It can go a lot darker.
And you haven't like thought about like going full Nico McBrain from Iron Maiden and having the toms that you can 360 around the whole way.
Wait.
Yeah, you just wait.
It's only a matter of time.
Well, I've just got a new drum kit, and it's set up in the studio right now. And all I can say is that I'm having a lot of fun on those toms.
How many have you got?
Set up at the moment, I have five.
Was it Chad Smith that broke the record for playing the most amount of drums? Was it? Can you tell me that?
Oh, no. I have no idea. I mean, it could have been. I wouldn't have guessed it would be Chad. I reckon it would have been someone way more geeky.
Thomas Lang.
So, like, how did it feel with the US taking to you so early?
It didn't feel like that, to be honest with you, because I think in context of how fast things were for us here, I remember we opened up for the Arctic Monkeys and it was like huge. And then our first show in the US was like three people there. And our dressing room was like just the corner of the room. Remember there was a used condom in the corner and just some empty beer, kind of burnt out. And there was actually a leak in the roof and it was raining so torrentially that it was just a fucking waterfall. So it didn't feel like we had like jumped straight into bed with America at all. We definitely were like back to the beginning. But once we got on the Pixies tour, that's when we kind of, yeah, we're playing in front of more people, and we noticed that every night we'd win them over. We'd get everyone would put their bucket of fucking chicken down or whatever they were eating. People would just be sitting down just eating, watching us.
It's it's like the cinema.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. But at the end, we'd always get them on their feet, and I noticed we were winning people over every single night. And then we got on the Foo Fighters tour, and suddenly that went to like stadiums. And it was this huge opportunity to, yeah, kind of win people over live, you know, which is hard to do. Because as a support band, especially for bands that big, you're kind of just in the way. You're just a bit of a nuisance.
Yeah.
And you're something to listen to while you go and get some beers and like get stocked up for the show, you know, your background music.
Mm-hmm.
So people over in those environments was, I think we knew, oh, hang on a minute, this is translating, even though we're unwanted strangers.
But it was a case that like a lot of the people that you went and toured with ended up becoming quite friends of yours, like the Arctic Monkeys and Queens of the Stone Age and Dave Grohl.
Yeah, I think there's such a small group of us that vibe off the same kind of energy of music, you know. So it's just, the rock room is very small. I guess we were like an obvious choice for those bands to bring out on the road, because particularly at that time, like, no one was really in a rock band like ours.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.